And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, August the 11th, 2015, 1:13 coming up on 1:14 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and this hour is going to be a fun hour. We are joined by a lady who does not do these interviews very often. I'm going to ask her when the last time she's done an interview is, but I've asked and pleaded that she come on this show because she is one of the funniest, and no joke here, one of the funniest ladies in the history of television and stand-up comedy. When she came on the scene in the late 1970s, she worked with some of the greats. Richard Pryor, you probably remember her best, though, as Roz the Bailiff from Night Court. She did a stint for 2 years on Empty Nest as Dr. Maxine Douglas, very funny show. She was on Smart Guy, DC Cab. She's done so much, and it is with great pride and privilege for the first time, but I hope not the last, that we welcome to these microphones Marcia Warfield. Marcia, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. So glad to hear your voice.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to provide it.
You know, Marcia, it's kind of interesting. I alluded to it there that I've been after you for a few years. You don't do these things very often.
Well, I haven't been working, and, you know, I didn't want to give false impressions, you know, that even though I'm not working, I'm still relevant. You know, I took the time off, and I just took the time off. And now that I'm starting to get back on the stage, now it makes sense.
Why did you take the time off? You were one of the biggest assets in Hollywood.
Oh, well, I think that's a kind of a stretch, but thank you. It was a family decision at the time. I was needed to be with my family, so that's what I did. Now that that situation has kind of stabilized and everything's better, now I can do for me what, you know, does for me.
Have you missed it?
Yes. Yes, of course. I mean, it's what I do. I'm a performer by nature, so yeah, I missed it. But, you know, you have to have priorities. You sometimes make choices, and you have to go for it, go with it. It's the same with performing, you know. You don't have to do it. You know, when you step out on that stage and say, I'm going to tell you some jokes and you're going to laugh, you got to go 100%. And so if you're not going to commit to things, then you just shouldn't do them.
What year was it you decided to step away?
I didn't decide, it just happened, but it was about 2001.
2001. So it's been 14 years. In that 14-year period, were people coming to you with scripts and ideas?
Well, that happens sometimes, but, you know, people tend to, show business is a very funny thing, you know. You step away and people let you. They don't, you know, really go, you know, come looking for you.
Was there anything that came along in that time that you thought, you know, I really have the urge to do this, even though the family issues were going on?
Well, there were a lot of things that I wish I had been available for. But, like I said, you can't let those things really get to you. You stick with your commitments, and you live with them, you know. But if it was up to me, I'd be all over Scandal, you know. I'd be Papa Pope. If it was up to me, I mean, he's got the best part on the show.
When did you decide, okay, it's time for me to get back out there?
Not very long ago. It's something I wanted to do, but being here in Vegas and the city of, you know, complete polished acts, starting again is not that easy. And so just in the past few days or weeks, I've just decided to take whatever opportunities are available to try and rework it out again. And get back on that horse.
when you are out for 14 years like that, how do you get back in? Do you hire an agent? Do you approach the club? How does that happen?
I have no idea. I'm taking it a step at a time, a day at a time. I take every... You know, if there was a formula for how to make it in show business, everybody would follow it. Nobody knows what the heck they're doing. You take every step, you know, you take a step and then you take another step. So that's basically, I'm basically starting all over again, writing new material, sending out feelers, talking to club owners, the whole thing from step one.
Do you think it's different? I would think it's different when a club owner or, because you're exactly right about, nobody knows the formula of what makes show business work, but when you have the visibility that a Marsha Warfield had for 7 years on Night Court, 2 years on Empty Nest, had your own talk show, people know the name, and if they don't, they can certainly look it up. Does that give you a leg up when you want to go into the club, get your foot back in the door?
Well, yes and no, you know, but, you know, there are expectations when people know a name, and so they might expect things that right now I'm not at the point to deliver. So there's a double-edged sword there. But then you also have, you know, show business is constantly evolving, and so it's being run by people who would have to Google Empty Nest. You know, they don't know Empty Nest. And Empty Nest to them is what, you know, maybe Casablanca was to me.
That's a good point. When you got back up on stage the first time, I've seen some pictures on your Facebook. What was that like?
It was familiar terror.
Mm.
You know, it's familiar terror. It's like, I don't know. You know, turning out the lights when you're seven, you know, at night, you know you're going to be scared, but you're used to it. I hadn't been on stage in a long time, so all of the stage, you know, fright, nerves and stuff come back. But then you get out there and it's kind of familiar, but, you know, it's like jazz. You know, you're making it up as you go along. So, but it worked out. It was better than I could have expected. The people are very nice, and they were very receptive. And so, you know, it didn't scare me off from doing it again.
And I'm sure it will be a success. When people will come to see Marsha Warfield do stand-up in 2015, what is she talking about?
She doesn't know. She will figure that out. She is talking about, you know, things. I'm a different person now, you know. I'm an older person. I'm a gay person. I'm a more politically aware person than I was. So all of those things will be part of it, but it's just, it'll be me talking to people and getting a response. But how that's going to go, we're figuring that out as we go along.
I'm always fascinated by the process. When you decided that you were going to do this, you sit down, do you write jokes? And if so, how was that done? How hard was that to get back into it?
That's a process that's always evolving. I've always, you know, I've jotted down different ideas, you know, throughout the years. Most of them are trash now. But still, you always write down observations and things, and then it's a matter of going back, going through it, writing, rewriting. You know, the process is more rewriting than writing. And then you take it to the stage, and the audience rewrites it for you. They tell you where the beats are. They tell you where the jokes are. They tell you where the laughs are. And you go from there.
That being said, when you got back on stage your first night, what got the biggest response? What is the one you said, this is staying in?
What did I don't even remember what I said. I started, the first line I ever did on stage was, "My name is Marsha Warfield and I'm a virgin." So I did that again. I figured at my age, saying that, if that doesn't get a laugh, you know, I'm lost. And it did. So that made everything else, you know, that kind of greased the wheels and made it work. And then I went on to explain to him why I said that line, you know, that it was the first line I ever did on stage. And that this was kind of like a Madonna re-virginance kind of thing, stepping out on stage again.
That being said, and I understand this is certainly in the early stages, would you like to ultimately see this as a comedy act that tours the country, or an act that gets you back into people's lexicon and you can do some more acting? What do you hope happens?
All of the above, and things I can't imagine. You know, I just want to, at this point, I just want to get back to doing stand-up. I started as a stand-up. Stand-up comedy is what I know best. But that being said, I love being part of an ensemble and being on television shows. I'd like another crack at talk show, because the kind of talk show I want to do, I don't know that anybody has done, you know.
You know, people forget this, but I do not forget this. Marsha Warfield did a talk show for one season, 1990 to 1991. This, when it first came out, I remember it being very critically well-received. It was different. Is that the talk show you would do today?
To a degree, yeah. But my idea, which flew in the face of everything, you know, conventional TV wisdom, my idea is to get different people on stage and talk to them in front of an audience of all kind of different people. I don't really want to go after demographics, you know. I want to go after people and have people talk to people about things that we don't talk to each other about, and we talk at each other about. And I think it would be interesting to, you know, get people from different backgrounds and different perspectives in the same room and just talk about stuff, you know, and see what they have. Kind of like what I do on Facebook. I asked the question the other day, just for the heck of it. I said, "Have you ever worn clown makeup?"
Mm.
I never expected the response we got. So many different people with so many different opinions and strong opinions about wearing clown makeup. And it's that kind of stuff. Everything from, you know, Ferguson to clown makeup. Let's talk about it.
You know, it's interesting, Marsha. A few years ago, I believe it was when Estelle Getty passed away, I was looking for you because we did several tribute shows to her. And we had David Leisure and Dinah Manoff on one night, and I said, "Do either of you know how to reach Marsha?" And they said, she's just off the radar. We're not sure where she is." And then one day, you reappeared on Facebook, and people thought it wasn't you in the beginning, and here you are.
Yes.
Is that fun?
If it's fun, I don't know. I don't know that it was about being fun. It was just, you know, sometimes I think that people, when you decide to take time off or you're not working, then you shouldn't work. You know, you just stay home. And when you're ready to be back out in the public eye, then come out, you know.
That's right.
I didn't want to be in a state of limbo where, what is she? What is she not? But no, I'm not working, so I'm not working. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't time. Now, it's time.
Perfect. And I want to learn some things here, Marsha. What was your childhood like? What was your growing up?
I grew up in the civil rights movement, you know. I'm as old as Brown and versus the Board of Education, and so it was a whole, and it was the 60s and 70s and the Vietnam War and Kennedy assassination and all these kind of things were going up when I was growing on, or going on when I was growing up. So it was an exciting, different kind of time that it's weird now that it's, you know, it's a historical point that people refer to and somehow shapes the discourse, but, you know, that was just part of growing up.
When you were in school in those days, when you were young Marsha Warfield, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I had no idea. And you have to understand that in the 60s, late 50s, 60s, 70s, women's choices weren't well defined. There just wasn't, nobody asked little girls what they wanted to be when they grew up. Little girls were going to be mommies and housewives when they grew up. And so if you had a career goal, it was something that was that complemented that, or, you know, you were a secretary or a teacher or a nurse. And that was about it. So those kind of thoughts just weren't part of, you know, I want to be a princess. Well, I didn't want to be a princess. That was stupid. But that's the kind of thing you had to deal with. You had to, if you wanted something, you were going against convention.
How did you become a stand-up with that premise?
I got divorced. I got married when I was 18. I got divorced. And I was working around working switchboards. The phone company and stuff like that. And then I heard about Tom Dreesen had an open mic night at a club called The Barrel. And it said in the paper that anybody could, you know, show up and sign up and do a few minutes. And I said, I want to do that. And a friend of mine, I said it to the wrong person, or the right person, because she said, then do it. And she made me do it. And so I went up. And that's the first, he introduced all the new acts as virgins. And so I went up and said, I'm Marsha Warfield and I'm a virgin. Mm. And that was the beginning.
And what made you good? When so many people fail at that, what made you a success?
That's another one of those intangibles that nobody knows. I have no idea. I went on stage, like I just told you, the audience laughed. They were receptive to me in a way I had no concept of expecting. You know what I mean? It's like I didn't know what to expect, but they were so open to me. And that's been the blessing all along. If the audience doesn't embrace you, there's, you know, nowhere to go. So even though I was raw and had no idea of really what I was doing, the audience reaction gave me the encouragement to keep trying to figure it out. And the comedians were so supportive and helpful that it just kept happening, and one step led to another.
Even when the people themselves are not the persona that they give off, Marsha Warfield is seen as a strong person, doctor, bailiff. When you stepped on the stage before all of that, did you have that strong personality?
I guess. I guess I did. You know, you have to I always likened it to a teacher. You know, you had some teachers who could walk in on the first day of school and get the kids' attention and hold it throughout the year. And then you had others who would walk into the room, and boys and girls, and the kids would run them out the room. And so I wanted to be that teacher, you know, have that kind of energy and project that on stage that says, you know, pay attention. I'm the teacher. And so I guess that's what came off.
One of the great television series that people unfortunately don't remember is Richard Pryor had a television series back in the 70s. You were on that series. How did you get that job?
Well, I think people do remember. A lot of people remember it very fondly and remember it to the degree that they quote it to me, you know, all the time. So, yeah, they remember. I got that job from working at the Comedy Store, and Paul Mooney was one of the writers on the show, and Paul did a lot of the casting, and he cast a lot of us from that he knew from the Comedy Store, and Richard would come to the Comedy Store and do stand-up, and we'd all stand around with our mouths open in awe, then he would watch the comics, and I think he had a lot of input into that as far as, you know, those of us he approved of, and that's how we all got on the show.
You're right, it is remembered very well, and certainly Richard Pryor on so many lists is listed as the greatest stand-up of all time, had his problems in life. What was Richard Pryor like when you worked with him?
He was like, I mean, you know, come on. It's hard to put into words when you. He was our idol. He could have been Attila the Hun, and it wouldn't have mattered. We would have still groveled at his feet. But he wasn't. He was always very nice and very receptive, and he would talk to us, and you know, we were peons, and he was God, and he would talk to us like we were equals, and he was just the nicest, funniest. He was a great guy as far to me. You know, I didn't know any of those other things about him, and it wouldn't have mattered if I did. It wasn't important.
Absolutely. Most people remember you. It still plays today on the Encore Network and a lot of other places. Night Court, one of the great television comedies of all time. You came in that series after it had been on, I think, 2 or 3 years. Selma Diamond and Florence Halep had passed away. You got the role as the bailiff. How did that happen?
Unfortunately, like you said, the two bailiffs before me died suddenly, and Flo passed away near the end of the hiatus. So they were getting ready to start again, and now they didn't have a bailiff for that role, and so they were trying to figure out exactly what they were going to do. They were planning to have revolving bailiffs from then on so as not to be caught in that situation ever again, I guess. I don't know. But I auditioned. I went in and I met with the producers, and Ryan Holbrigge, who's no longer with us, Ryan said he was from Chicago and I was from Chicago, so we talked about Chicago, and I was wearing sweats and I was smoking at the time. I had cigarettes. I just knew that I had blown the audition. So I wasn't expecting anything, but I got a call. By the time I got home, they said, they love you. They want you to start next week. And I was okay. And it took off from there.
What was that show like, working on the inside?
99.9% of it was great, and so the tiny percentage that wasn't isn't all that important. It was a great learning experience for me. It was a great, I've been lucky to be in really good shows with really good people. And I got to learn a lot, and I got to get paid.
Night Court was very interesting in that it ran for 9 seasons, was a top 10 show a lot of the time, and yet no real reunions, it's not talked about a lot. People still love the reruns. Haven't seen a whole lot of DVD releases of the show. Why do you think it's that way? Most of the cast is still alive.
Have no idea. You know, it's one of those things. We were kind of always the stepchild of the must-see TV lineup, you know. If there was the Cosby Show, and what else was on?
Cheers.
Michael J. Fox. What was the name of? I'm blanking on this.
Family Ties.
Yeah. And then Cheers, and then Night Court. And so those shows always seemed to be the ones that got all the attention, and we were like the zany, uncle that you only let out for family functions, you know, the barbecue. You invite, your crazy uncle Clem. And so we were like the crazy uncle show.
Want to ask you about some of the actors on that show, because we don't hear a whole lot about them, but it has to have been fun to work with them. What was Harry Anderson like?
Harry is a sweetheart. He's a very nice man. He's very funny. Everybody was very down to earth and just, really cool people. It's hard to give any other description, because we all just got along fine, and they embraced me from day one.
Do you have a favorite episode of that show?
Wow. My favorite episode? I liked them all. There were moments in all of them that just, I don't know that my favorite episodes would be ones I was in. I got a kick out of working with Elaine Boozler, as she and I had been doing stand-up together forever, so when she was on the show, that was a kick. Yakov, Smirnoff, when he was on the show. The Mel Torme shows were great, and then we had, we would have guests we had Johnny Carson, Burt Parks, it's hard to say which was a favorite. I did a show, I had an episode with Don Cheadle when he was brand new, and that was a great show, a little more serious than we usually did, and
I remember the one where you found out on the show that your character was diabetic. I thought that was very good.
That was an interesting show. That was a four-parter that spanned the end of one season and the beginning of the next. And it was really, Harry was, I don't know if Harry had gotten fired. He pulled off a big prank where he put a nose and glasses on the Statue of Liberty. And Roz found out she had diabetes. That was the subplot of that show, that arc. And it was like I said, a four episode thing that we did.
It's interesting. I heard John Larroquette say in an interview one time that when you came on, it was like you were bigger than life. And I think that's true. Very popular, became a hugely popular character, offered your own talk show during the run of the series. Was there ever any jealousy or anything from the cast?
Well, that's a hugely flattering thing for him to have said, especially considering that at the time, he owned the Emmy nominations and Emmy wins for Best Actor in a Comedy Series for about 4 or 5 years running, if not longer. So for him to say that about me is, you know, it's flattering, but the show was getting the recognition. It was getting the critical acclaim it was an hysterically funny show and a popular show. And all of the cast was very much loved. And you know, I was the sixth bill. And that's, you know, that's the way it should have been. I mean, they were all doing Harry had come from doing stints on Cheers as Harry the Hat, and he was being nominated, and the show was being nominated, and John was winning Emmys, and you know, so I was just trying to hold my own against this, you know, company that I found myself thrown into.
When a series like that reaches the end after 9 years, you were with it for 7. What was the last episode like? Was it hard to leave?
We never got. We didn't know whether we were going to be canceled or not, so we didn't really wrap up the. You know, we didn't get a send off. We didn't know if we were going to be picked up over the summer or what. So when we found out for sure that we hadn't been picked up, it was like right at the very end. And so it was a different kind of, we didn't get a chance to prepare for the end. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so when they said it's all over and that's it, it was kind of a bittersweet, you know. And there were tears and all that kind of stuff. But then it was a happy, fun set. You know, people always said they liked working on the set because it was a fun set. You had all these comics and funny people, and it just was a fun set to do. So there was that. But I didn't do well. I broke into tears at the end of the thing, like, bawled like a baby.
You were a gigantic star when Night Court ended, hot property. NBC obviously wanted to keep you, and they plant you in another one of their hit series, which had been on 5 years at that point, Empty Nest. How did it come about that was the series you would end up in?
Luck, just luck. You know, I just was lucky enough to be cast in that show, in that role. And that was another great experience. I mean, all those people and Richard Mulligan and Dinah and David. And it was just a, you know, I just fell into some really good parts and in some really good shows. You don't know how, here again, that's one of those things, if there was a blueprint, I would make $1 million. But there isn't, so.
How was the Empty Nest set different from the Night Court set?
It wasn't as wacky. You know, we were a wacky show. Night Court was a wacky show, and we were a wacky group of people. There was more structure on the Empty Nest set, but other than that, you know, the camaraderie and the professionalism and all that stuff was still there. It was still a great place to work.
I do want to ask you about two members of that cast who are no longer with us, because I loved both of these people and they were just great. What was it like working with Richard Mulligan?
Oh, he was a sweetheart. you know, when you find out these people are just people, down to earth, just good people, it kind of blows you away. I mean, you go into it as a professional, hopefully, but you also go into it as a fan. I mean, I watch soap. You know, I had seen him in movies and so I was as starstruck as anybody else. But he was a very supportive actor, very supportive person, and I like to think we became friends, not just co-workers.
And the other one I wanted to ask about, of course, is the great Estelle Getty.
Estelle was adorable. She was just adorable. And again, another very supportive person who I had ultimate respect for. And so we would sit and talk, and she was just great to watch. She was great to learn from. It was just, you know, very, very professional, wonderful, supportive set group of people. I got no complaints.
You know, Empty Nest was a long-running series as well, 7 years on NBC. You were with it for the last two. I think Empty Nest, though, knew that the end was coming. Was that a hard send-off?
I think, no, it was a little different. Everybody was... it's always hard to say goodbye, you know? It's always hard to end something that you work hard at. But I don't remember it being as chaotic, I guess, as far as the uncertainties that were around the Night Court ending. It was more like, you know, graduation.
You know, people have an idea, I think, who remember these shows, and I do think they remember them well. Marsha Warfield is a strong character. We talked about it earlier. How close is Marsha Warfield to those characters, Roz and the Doctor Maxine on Empty Nest?
Well, you know, I think it's always going to be close to me because it's me. You know what I mean? But I think that both those characters had vulnerabilities too, and there were times when Roz dating and in her personal life might not have been as secure as we would expect. And like when she had diabetes and she was didn't really know how to cope with that, and you know, Maxine Douglas had her moments when she would second-guess her diagnosis and is she doing the best for her patients and those kinds of things. Strength is not so much always being forceful. Sometimes it's admitting that you're weak, you know? And so, like everybody, there are those moments when it ain't all about being the strongest one in the room, the one being strong enough to say, hey, come on, we can all cry together.
When you look back at the career so far, and there's definitely a lot to come, but do you have any regrets?
Everybody has regrets. Of course I have regrets. I regret, you know, you regret when you leave the stage. I go on stage, I do a joke, it doesn't work, or I should have or could have said it different. There are always going to be regrets. Regrets are part of effort. If you don't have regrets, you didn't ever try anything. So sure, I have plenty of regrets, but then I have a lot of triumphs. So I wouldn't trade them.
When you look back at the childhood you grew up with, at this point in your life, age and stage where you are now, does it seem like a dream? Does it seem amazing?
Oh, it's always been amazing. I used to always say, even at the height of whatever success, if I had to quit now, I could not complain. I've met so many people that were idols and people I admired and looked up to. I've been so many places. I've gotten to do so many things that I didn't ever imagine that I would. That I, you know, even at the worst of time, I got no kick coming.
When you look back at it so far, what do you consider to be the personal high? What was the best moment in the career?
Whew, I don't have one. I have lots. I mean, really lots. Lots and lots. I got to do Mandela's farewell tour at the Coliseum in Los Angeles in front of 70,000 people. I got to do the Richard Pryor show, where the first time I ever did a sketch improvised without rehearsal on TV was with Richard Pryor on his show. I got to work with some of the great music legends opening for him. I got to work with Carlin. What do you want? I can't pick.
that's pretty good.
There are lots of heights.
Well, on the flip side of the coin, was there a low? Was there something you wish you had not done? And not so much as a regret, just it was a bad day. That wasn't the best.
Oh, that happens. Bombing is part of comedy. And the bigger the shows you do, the bigger chance you get to just bomb. And it happens to everybody. And yeah, I've had those too. And, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. Sometimes it happens, you know. You do it again tomorrow night.
It's kind of interesting. You have really had an arc in show business, hitting primetime television in the late 1970s and still in it today in 2015. You mentioned it earlier on. I don't know if people knew it or didn't know it. You mentioned that you are gay. Has that been trouble? Is it easier now than it was then?
Well, I don't know. I don't know yet because I wasn't out the last time I performed publicly. So this is all new. And so we'll see how it goes.
Was that a hard decision to come out?
It was the only decision. It's like, you know, it's like announcing that it's daytime when the sun is shining. You know, it was so obvious and true, and anybody who has known me has known that I'm gay, but, you know, it was just time to stop not admitting it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
As opposed to just not saying anything as I had been doing.
Was it a conscious decision at the height not to mention that?
Yeah, pretty much. That was just the way it was done. And, you know, I didn't really come out. Well, coming out is such a quaint expression, and it conjures up this idea in people's minds that you do like a Carol Burnett or Nora Desmond, you know, coming out of the door and going, "I'm gay," you know, wearing a Scarlett O'Hara's drapes or something. And it's just not that way. It's a series of steps you take, and you tell this person and you tell that person. And basically, along the way, all you're really doing is telling people what they know already. But finally making people stop, pretend that you're not, you know? Mm. It's a secret you really can't keep.
Before we let you go, Marcia, and this has been a tremendous amount of fun, and I hope your first foray back into interviews is not your last, and certainly not your last appearance on this show, because I've enjoyed this greatly.
Well, thank you so much, and you've made it relatively painless.
I hope so. I hope so. I hope it wasn't anything bad at all.
No, it's not.
But I wanted to ask you, because one thing you do on Facebook is you do tackle current events. And in the last few minutes here, is there anything you wanted to speak on, from Donald Trump to Bill Cosby to any of the big stories that we have in the lexicon right now?
You know, at this point, I think the driving force in everything is social media. And social media is shaping conversations in a way that's good and that's not so good. You know what I mean? But it is a fact. More voices are being heard, and as far as the Black Lives Matter and all that kind of stuff, I was thinking, we're all Ida B. Wells now. We're all speaking out on the social injustices, and that's a good thing. But I don't know that it always, and I'm not just talking about that thing. I'm talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about all of it. I don't know if it really reflects what it really reflects. It's just so interesting to watch. And so I like hearing different people's point of view. It's like I said, what a talk show. I would love to have a talk show where we would all talk about it. All of us, and not talk at each other, but talk to each other so that we could, you know, get into some face-to-face and really hear each other. Because I don't know that we're as far apart as we think we are.
That being said, it just in particular, because of the business you're in, what is just your thumbnail sketch of the Bill Cosby situation?
You know, the way I look at it is, I've always respected Dr. Cosby. I've met him. I have no firsthand experience that would shine any light on anything. He's always been a gentleman to me. He's always been Bill Cosby. Having said that, as a woman who's always been sensitive to women's issues, and at this point in my life, I can't dismiss so many allegations from so many women. So it's a very uncomfortable position to be in. You know, I respect his talent, I respect his contribution, I respect him as, you know, the performer he's always been, but I cannot dismiss these women's allegations. So I just don't know.
not that you're going anywhere, Marcia, but years from now, when people look back at your body of work, what do you hope they say about Marcia Warfield in her time?
Wow.
a deep wow. Question to end on.
Okay. She did it, you know.
I would agree. You did do it.
She did it. That's. I hope they have an opinion, whatever it is. It would be so fulfilling to think that people have an opinion about you, because most people never get known for anything. So to think that people would have an opinion one way or the other is enough in itself.
I think after hearing today's program, the opinion of the listeners and certainly the opinion of me is that Marcia Warfield is a nice lady who has been making us laugh for many years and is going to continue. We're so glad you're back doing things. I'm so glad you came on after so many years, and I really do sincerely hope you come back from time to time and share your opinions, because I think you're exactly right. Just come on and talk, and that is in some way a release when these current events do happen.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate that you've giving me the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcia.
Bye-bye. All right. Bye-bye.
Marcia Warfield, one of the truly great comedians of all time. You might remember her as Roz from Night Court or Dr. Maxine Douglas from Empty Nest. Stay tuned. Much more here on WWGH Radio.
107.1 FM.
This is Charlie.